We are privileged to have with us today Dr. Doug Bookman, an old friend of mine and Nancy's. We met many years ago in the mid-90s when I joined the faculty, the Bible faculty at the Master's University, and we've been friends ever since. And unfortunately, we don't get to see each other a whole lot, but when we do, we pick up. You know how that works. You pick up where you left off and go on. But he and his wife, Diane, befriended us in a very dear way when we lived in California. I've had great respect for Doug Bookman down through the years. He's a professor of Old and New Testament exposition at the Shepherd's Theological Seminary in Cary, North Carolina. A wonderful seminary, and you can go online and read more about that. But he's a very gifted Bible teacher and a man that dearly loves the Lord. And so we're honored to have him come and minister the Word of God to us this morning. Doug?
Thank you, my man. All right, well, it is an absolute delight to be with you, and I appreciate the opportunity. And as David says, we have been, and we don't get to see each other much to reinforce it, but it never dissipates the friendship and the respect and the regard, and I'm so thrilled with what God is doing here at Calvary Bible. Now, I'd like to focus, you know, Easter is 10 weeks off, but there's never a bad time or an inappropriate time to ponder the events of that blessed eight-day week. And Sunday to Sunday, if it were 7 days, we wouldn't be here this morning. But let me just, I want to focus on one element of that week that I think is fascinating, and it's an interesting, I think, study in the gospel narratives. And to introduce it, I want to ask the question. I want to talk about the triumphal entry. Sunday morning, when Jesus rode into the city in fulfillment of three deliberate lines of Old Testament predictive prophecy, and was welcomed wildly. The whole city turned out to welcome him. And I want to ask you this question, or I want to ponder this question. How did Jesus get away with the triumphal entry? Now, what I mean by that is you got to understand that at this point, In the history of the world, at this point, the Roman Empire was neonate. It formally dates itself, or historians date it from 27 BC, and this is 33 AD. So the Roman Empire is newly minted, if you don't mind, and in establishing themselves, without going into the Punic Wars and the defeat of Macedonia and so on. But there were a lot of empire, the former empires, kingdoms, small, large, around the Mediterranean world and slightly beyond, that could remember when they were running their own affairs. But now Rome has taken control, has crushed them. And so the point is that the Roman Empire will not, cannot tolerate sedition, pretender kings. And yet Jesus rides into the city as king. Now let me develop that just a little further. The one place in the Roman Empire where they had more seditious activity than anywhere else was Israel. And the one place, you see, the Romans had a pretty, their policy was, if you raise your hand against Rome, we're going to put it down if we can in hours, but at the most days. We're going to bring such overwhelming force. They didn't worry about collateral damage. That was a strategy. The blood is going to run for months. But when Israel, when a sedition would arise in Israel, as it often did, and the last big one that took Rome 2 years to put down was in 6 AD, and that's the rebellion referred to by Gamaliel when the man Judas gathered a force and so on. So here we are some years later, less than two decades later, And the reason that it was so difficult for Rome to put down rebellions in Israel is because, I like to say, Israel is like one big paintball arcade. Do you still do paintball? I mean, it's just made for guerrilla warfare. And Rome knew overwhelm phalanx force, you know, and so they were especially skittish about rebellions, pretender kings in Israel. And the one place where it most often happened was Jerusalem. And the one season of the year when it was most likely to erupt was Passover. Why? Well, what is every Jewish person thinking about at Passover? They're thinking about a time. I'm thinking about my computer here. It's very fussy. I got to make sure they keep the power. I'll be in trouble. They're thinking about the Exodus. They're thinking about the time when, in fulfillment of a very specific promise, Genesis 15, God raised up a deliverer and delivered his covenant people. I say he delivered. He dragged them out by the nose. They didn't want to leave, let me tell you something. But nonetheless, it was not so much about getting Israel out of Egypt. It was about God demonstrating his covenant-keeping character by fulfilling a promise that he had made to Abraham in Genesis 15. Your descendants are going to go down into a land that's not theirs. After 400 years, I'm bringing them out. Now, my point is the whole Jewish world stops to celebrate the fact that there was a time when God, in fulfillment of a promise, delivered his people from a Gentile overlord. Well, guess what? The generation to which Jesus came had a promise. Do you know Daniel 9? He's got a ticking clock, if you don't mind. So my point is, here in a day and a place where the Romans will not tolerate sedition, and not only the Romans are at stake, but of course the Jewish leadership had determined to kill Jesus, and yet he rides into Jerusalem, and neither Jewish nor Roman authorities lift a hand to stop him. Now, you know, I love to study the life of Christ. I love to put the four Gospels together and come to as full and coherent an understanding of Jesus' life as we can. What I mean by coherent, it's got to make sense historically. And one of the questions that is not very much asked is, how did Jesus get away with it? Does that make sense to you? Are you intrigued? Are you interested? You know the one guy who goes back to this all the time, maybe you don't know his name, but we live down the street from him, is a man named Bart Ehrman. Anybody know Bart Ehrman? He's the go-to apostate, failed evangelical and so on. And he's saying this all the time to make the case that the Bible's not true. Now, you tell this big story about Jesus writing, nobody writes, that can't happen. Well, it did happen. And I think the Bible gives us an intriguing and instructive answer to the question, how did Jesus get away with it? Now, I want to start out, I want to take you to a number of passages, and I have one here, and you can find it. It's Matthew 10 and verse 16. And let me just do something here. Matthew 10 and verse 16. And I hate to just pick a passage off the page, but I can't spend too much time, but suffice it to say, this is a part of that remarkable commissioning sermon that Jesus gave to his 12 disciples. It's late in the Galilean ministry. Jesus' enemies are gaining greater and greater influence, and Jesus takes the 12 and he sets them out two by two, not to go as independent evangelistic teams, but to go before him as sort of front men. The time is short. And so rather than just Jesus going from place to place, he comes up with a strategy because he lived out what he says right here. He comes up with a strategy to send his disciples out and to announce that he's coming, as it were. In other words, rather than just every little village, go to two or three villages and say, next Tuesday, under the big bay tree, in that village over there, the Nazarene miracle worker, by the way, will be here. So he's sending them out. It's urgent. He knows it's urgent. But he says this in verse 16, behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, and therefore, now I want to come back to that therefore. He says, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And the word that he uses for wise here is not the standard biblical word of skillful living. It means clever. It means strategic. It means very, very deliberately framing their ministry to buy up every possible advantage and put the enemy at every possible disadvantage. It really is to be clever, wise as serpents, but harmless as doves. And without stopping on it, folks, this is number one. This is your commission and mine. We have no right to be careless with the resources, the spiritual resources that God gives us. But this balance of wise as serpents, but never, ever compromising any principle of morality or ethics and so on, it's really just a beautiful picture. Now, the word therefore, the way it is in the English, and I understand this, but we would think that the thought of the verse is, because you are going as sheep in the midst of wolves, therefore be wise as serpents. Really, the Greek is quite explicit by reason of word order. And what he is saying is this, behold, I am the one sending you. You are going in my name, in my stead, and therefore, because I'm the one sending you, be wise as serpents. In other words, you need to reflect who I am, and therefore be wise as serpents. And we talked yesterday morning just a little bit about the importance of acknowledging the genuine humanity of Jesus and so on, and avoiding the Clark Kent approach to Jesus. And when you're careless in that regard, it's easy to miss this, that Jesus was so clever. And I'm going to walk you through what I think about, well, I'm going to walk you through it. You decide. The plan, the strategy, the stunningly clever plan that Jesus came up with so that he could, in fact, on the appointed day, enter the city of Jerusalem safely. And I think the Bible gives us the answer. How did Jesus get away with it? And the answer basically is that he was so clever. And listen, folks, I would suggest that the plan that he lays out and the plan that is going to eventuate in his fulfilling those Old Testament prophecies so carefully as he enters the city, it's a plan that you and I could have figured out if we were clever enough. He's within the limitations of unfallen humanity. He was clever enough to come up with. All right, now, let me take you to another verse. And that is what I think it's good to start here. And this is what Pastor read just a moment ago. And let me just say, I'm not going to go back over it very much. Well, you need to know what's going on here. Jesus is in Perea. Perea is on the eastern side of the Jordan River, Jordan today. And he's there because just a few weeks ago, we don't know exactly how long, but just a few weeks ago, he had been in Jerusalem for the Feast of Dedication. This is John chapter 10, verse 22. He came to Jerusalem, and it was the Feast of Dedication. By the way, dedication, what's the Feast of Dedication? You know, how do we call that? Hanukkah. They're remembering dedicating the temple on the day of the Hasmoneans. So it's late December in John chapter 10, and Jesus comes to the feast, and he makes the claim to be, I and the Father are one. That so enrages his Pharisaic enemies. They take up stones to stone him. And because he is so clever, he knew he had to flee. And so he simply leaves Jerusalem across the Kidron, down the backside of the Mount of Olives, crosses the Jordan River, about 15 miles, and now he's in the region of Herod Antipas. All right, I shouldn't stop. But you see, Rome had been provincialized in 6 AD. In other words, rather than a client kingdom, it had become a province, which means Rome just dispatches governors there. And they were called prefects, and the fifth of those governors was Pilate, all right? So in Judea and Samaria, they are ruled by a succession of Roman governors, and the one at the time is Pilate at this time. Pilate, the Jews in Jerusalem could get Pilate to dance to the tune they piped. They had so much leverage. I could go into it. But on the other hand, Herod Antipas, the Jews had no leverage in Herod Antipas's life. Herod Antipas was one of the three sons to whom Herod the Great had willed his kingdom and so on. He had Galilee to the north and Perea to the east. But like I say, they had no leverage. And so Jesus knew that the Jewish leadership was not going to be able to do him harm if he's in Perea. Does that make sense to you? He's gone there because he's wise as a serpent. Now, While he is there, some Pharisees came and they said, get out and depart from here, for Herod wants to kill you. That's Herod Antipas. And this is a cheap ploy. Now, I can give you a whole page of arguments to demonstrate, but this is, let me tell you something. The Pharisees are not concerned about the safety of Jesus, but they know they can't get him dead if he's in Perea. They have to get him over to Judea. And so they come with this trick, and Jesus says, nothing doing. Now, look, real quickly, he said to them, go tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I'll be perfected. What in the world is that about? And the commentators stumble all over it. Listen, folks, number one, do everything you can. Learn to read the Bible in terms of its own culture. And this is, Jesus is a, you know, the Bible was written to be read aloud. And therefore, the writer has to, the writer can't count on, well, I'm not saying this well. Hebrew is rich with ways that you can insinuate nuance and emphasis and so on in the text, in the words on the page. Has to be that way because it's going to be read aloud. They don't have any exclamation points. They don't have any italics. That doesn't exist. So Hebrew is just so rich with these nuances that are built into the text. And one of them was what's called the progressive, there's a name for it, and it just, I'm an old guy. But the point is, well, it's let's say it's called the, I can't remember, progressive, shame on me. But you're familiar with it, even if I can't remember the name of it. Because, here, finish this sentence for me from Proverbs. Six things doth the Lord hate, yea, verily, seven are an abomination to him. Three things are more than I can understand, yea, four. Confuse me. For two sins of Moab, yea, verily, three. It's always X. Numerical progression, that's what it's called, the numerical progression. And it's a figure of speech, and it's very, very Jewish. And again, it's born of the fact that you have to be able to put whatever you want to communicate in the actual words on the page. So what he is saying, it always represents fullness. In other words, it's not that the Lord only hates these seven things, 16, 8, 8, 7, it's that he really, really hates these things. That makes sense to you? And so what Jesus is saying is, I'm not going to fall for your silly little ploy, but I'm going to minister today and tomorrow and on the third day. In other words, when the time is full. I will come, but it'll be when the time is full. Does that make sense to you? And then, and this is so moving, and because now, we stop with verse 34, but I want to read the last verse as well. Because now, think about this. Here is Jesus in Perea. Some 20, we don't know exactly where he was, 20 to 30 miles from Jerusalem. These men who run things in Jerusalem, these Pharisees, and by the way, you can see a Pharisee coming about a mile off. You know, their blue is bluer, and their fringe is longer, and their turbans are higher, and they carry themselves with such authority. And so here you are, and Jesus, by the way, he's over here in Perea, and thousands of people have come from Judea and Galilee to hear him. Folks, I shouldn't stop on this, but try and get in the moment and imagine the excitement by this time. How many degrees of separation? Can we still use that phrase? How many degrees of separation? By this time, this is late in Jesus' ministry, after the Galilean ministry, after the Judean ministry. It's within about 7 months of, no. It's within several weeks of his crucifixion. But how many degrees of separation might there have been between anybody in Israel and somebody who had been healed? Can you imagine the excitement? And not only is there the excitement born of the fact that, like I say, he's healed so many, but it's rather exciting that the Pharisaic leadership is so mad at him. And so he goes over to Perea, and thousands of people come, and he's teaching, he's doing miracles, and now these Pharisees, who are mad beyond words, they come and they say, so they've come all this way from Jerusalem to trick Jesus into, with murder in their hearts is the point. And Jesus looking at them, he weeps over Jerusalem from afar. But he says, we read this before, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets, stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you were not willing. And now, look at verse 35. I say this for you. This is so big. See, your house is left to you desolate, and assuredly I say to you, you shall not see me until the time comes when you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, that phrase, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, we probably ought to do this, is right out of Psalm 118. So let me take you to Psalm 118, and look at there. Here, I like to do this. This psalm is I like to call it the Psalm of Messianic Inauguration. It was the song that Yahweh gave Israel to teach them how to receive their Messiah. And when Jesus, and here it is right here in verse 26, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And Jesus is saying to those murderous Pharisees and in the company of all that crowd, you're not going to see me until you sing Psalm 118 and welcome me as Messiah. That's exactly what he's saying. You're not going to see me until you welcome me as Messiah. Now, I start here because I want you to think, I got to get to the triumphal entry, don't I? But I want you to realize that Jesus gives just weeks before, we don't know how many weeks, but only weeks before the triumphal entry, in that encounter with the Pharisees from Jerusalem, he makes a stunning predictive promise. And if you'd have been there that day, you'd have said, ho, 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 that is not going to happen. These Pharisees despise Jesus. They're going to be madder in a couple of weeks. And they own Jerusalem, and the Judea checks their minds at the door of these Pharisees, if you don't mind. This is not going to happen. It happened. And we're going to see how it happened. Now, let me go back. Notice there are a couple other phrases here. Number one, save now, I pray. Do you see that in the green? That's part of the psalm. Save now. Can you say that in Hebrew? Do you know? Hoshana. We have this word Hosanna, which is just kind of an empty prayer. Not empty, but it doesn't have any deliberate connotation on its own part. It means something. It means please save now. And so they were taught when Messiah appears, and we're not talking about salvation from Rome here. We're talking about salvation from the curse of sin in Genesis chapter 3. Now, maybe you already saw it, but there's another verse in this psalm that everybody in the room knows by heart. Did you already see it? Right there. This is the day the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. Let me tell you something, folks. I'm not getting after anybody. But I know it may be your habit to, you know, get up in the morning and throw open the drapes and, oh, this is the day which the Lord has made. Help yourself. But that's not what that's talking about. It's talking about one day, March 29th, 33 AD. It's talking about the day when Messiah finally appears. And you're taught to understand, you're taught to sing, this is the day which Yahweh, we couldn't imagine. This is the day that Yahweh has prepared for us, and we will rejoice. And the reason, of course, when those Sadducees insisted that the people receiving Jesus, especially the children, stop singing, Jesus said the very stones would cry out. Why? Because this is the day which the Lord has made. We've waited for it ever since Genesis 3. All right, so let me take you to another passage. I'm in deep trouble, but I'm going to hurry. I want to go to John, and specifically to the raising of Lazarus. I had this all set up. What in the world? But I can do it. So let me take it to John chapter 11 and verse 45. Now, I've got to be really quick here. But this is the raising of Lazarus and how I would like to walk you through this story. But understand this, that this happens within weeks of when Jesus, of the Passion Week and the Triumphal Entry. Very few weeks. He's still in Perea. Somebody comes, the one whom you love is sick. Jesus waits 2 days. We talked about this yesterday morning, so that when he shows up, it's the fourth day. And now the death stench that's going to roll on that has Martha so concerned is going to be demonstration that this man, Lazarus, is genuinely dead. And the only miracle I think that I can find where Jesus deliberately contrived to make it more dramatic than it might have been is when he waits 2 days, so he shows up on a fourth day, and you have that dynamic of the death stench. That makes sense to you. But the point is, John, as is his wont, gives us the narrative, and then he gives us the results. And I've got to go quickly. I'm just going to outline it for you. It's right here in the text. But first of all, some of the Jewish leaders who came that day, says there in verse 45, many of the Jews, and by that he means the leadership, believed. But others went and told the Sanhedrinists, and oh, such an interesting passage. But suffice it to say that Caiaphas, who is the true villain in the Passion narrative and who hounded Jesus to death, but Caiaphas, the very, very crooked fourth generation high priest, fourth in that family. But he says this. One of them, Caiaphas, said right here. Well, this is actually the council. They said, what shall we do? This man works many signs. Now, time out. There's a biblical answer to that question. If a man comes, signs are the means by which God proves a man claim that he's speaking for God. So I like to say, if a man comes with signs, has a message from God, you take two steps. Number one, you always check the scriptures, because the first disqualifier of somebody who claimed to have a message is there anything he is saying which is inconsistent with what went before? That's number one. Number two is you bow the knee. He's speaking for God. So there's an answer to that question, what shall we do? He works many signs. Here's their answers. If we let him alone, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away our place and our nation, our cushy spot. And so let me jump down to verse 53. From that day on, they plotted to put Jesus to death. And in verse 57, it says, now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it that they might seize him. Look, by the time Jesus gets to the triumphal entry, I mean, after this is in Perea. In a little while, he's going to go over to raise, matter of fact, he's going to go over to raise Lazarus from the dead. And do you remember what Thomas said when he said we need to go to minister to him? Let's go die with him. Right here in this chapter. That's how dangerous it was for Jesus to go into. Now, he's going to go to Bethany, which is just on the eastern slope of the Mount of Olives, just a suburb of Jerusalem. But the point is, my point is, there's a price on it. He's a fugitive. He has to be so circumspect the way he carries himself, because the most powerful men in the Jewish nation are angry beyond words, and they have determined, right here, they put a price on his head. So number one, Jesus is a fugitive. Number two, this is John's section here, where, because John is so, I won't get into too much of the Gospel of John, but his habit is not only to give us a full story, but then to tell us exactly how it played out. And in the first place, Jesus is a fugitive. In the second place, right here in verse 54, no, let's go to verse 55 first. Verses 55 and 56, it says, the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem for the Passover to purify themselves. All right, quickly. I think you're familiar with this. But Passover is a pilgrimage feast, and Jews came from all over. But if you had incurred any sort of uncleanness, you'd had a communicable disease, you'd touched a human dead body, as a woman you'd born a baby, and so on, before you could go, you had to report to the priests and be appropriately cleansed according to Levitical law. And so before the Passover happened, before the week arrived, the city would begin to swell with these people who were coming in for purification. And then John gives us this. Oh, listen, John is so, he is very deliberately fleshing out the story in the gospel, in the synoptics. And he gives us this insight. He says, they sought Jesus, these pilgrims who had come, and spoke among themselves. Now, what that means is they spoke among themselves. It means they whispered, because they knew the leadership was angry. But they said, they stood in the temple, they said, what do you think, that he'll not come to the feast? So John tells us that the whole city of Jerusalem is a buzz with the question, do you think the Nazarene's coming? Folks, there's no other show in town. There's nothing going on. If the Super Bowl was that afternoon, nobody would have showed up, all right? This is all about this, that there's nobody, and the raising of Lazarus is what precipitated this. So the point is, the whole city is abuzz. And then he says this, in verse 54, John says, therefore Jesus no longer walked openly, he's being very circumspect, but he went from there into the country near the wilderness, and it means the border between Judea the south and Samaria the north, to a city called Ephraim. Now, the city is probably still there. It's called Ophrah today. And there he remained with his disciples. All right, so we're going to harmonize scriptures. Because Jesus, after the raising of Lazarus, because there is a price on his head, hides himself in a village just north of Jerusalem, about 5 miles, called Ephraim. Now, let me take you to Luke chapter 17, and this is harmonizing the Gospels. In Luke 17, Luke picks the story up. Now, let me say, remember that Jesus was a Galilean. He was raised in Nazareth up until he went to minister. Then he lived out his life even in the Galilee ministry up in Capernaum. And you remember Luke 2 says that they would go up every year to Passover. Remember that you have the story of Jesus at the age of 12, but it says that every year Joseph would take his family faithfully to Passover. So Jesus knew the habits of the Galilean Jews with regard to Jerusalem. And that's where I'm going to take you. Now, let me see if this won't work. I have a PowerPoint. Can you see that? Yeah, it's kind of fine, but here's what's at stake. And I've highlighted some things here, but I want to, it said, oh, I should say, Luke 17, 11, and I gave it there to you there in the King James, because that's the real Bible. No, I'm kidding. Okay, I'm kidding. Don't give me anymore. But it does, you see, all right, let me just read it. It says, it came to pass, now remember, John has him at Ephraim. I'll point it out to you. You have it there, just north of Jerusalem. I know it's a small map. But it says, as it came to pass, as he went to Jerusalem, that he passed through the midst of, and both the prepositions used and the case endings used, it means exactly that. Now, other translations mess with it. I'll tell you something. I love the King James. I listen to the King James. I was reared in the King James. Okay, it slips out of me, but I don't regard it as the most worthy translation for us. But at any rate, other translations, they have through the coasts of or something. Why? Because you know enough geography looking at the map and anyway to know that if you pass through Samaria and then Galilee, you got Jerusalem in the rearview mirror, right? So why does it say, as he went to Jerusalem, that he passed through the heart of Samaria and Galilee? Glad you asked. And I think this is so key to what's going on. So I give you some, I'm sorry, it's so key to answering the question we want to, this is where Jesus is wise as a serpent. Now stay with me, if you will. Let me just do a little with this map. I've highlighted here, you've got Judea to the south in the red, you can see that. Samaria to the north, and remember, for any number of reasons, but they were very real and defining reasons for that culture, the Samaritans had no dealings with the Jews, and especially at feast season. So, and then you have Galilee to the north. Now, Galilee is the good living, all right? Judea's tough. Judea's a tough place to live, Jerusalem. But way to the north, up around the Sea of Galilee, you have what Josephus calls the ambition of nature. If nature could grow up and be what it wants to be, it would be Galilee. It's beautiful, beautiful. Just these, especially from that day, just beautiful fields that stretch up the rolling hillsides, very open. You can put a road most anywhere, plenty of rain. It's just one of the most beautiful spots on earth in every way, especially agricultural. And let me say this, wherever you are in the Bible, know this. You're reading about a people who live from harvest to harvest. Starvation is always a real possibility. So Galilee with its spreading fields and its ample rain, oh my goodness, it was. Now, for that reason, when the Hasmoneans, those Maccabean guys, you may remember from the intertestamental period, just about 100 years before Christ, 102, I think it was, B.C., they had conquered Galilee. And thousands, tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of people who had been living in that little small area around Jerusalem. They came back under Zerubbabel to build the temple and so on, and they had walled the city. But it was tight. And so when it was open, they flooded up to Galilee. Here, why is it that two Davidic families from Bethlehem are living in Nazareth, the family of Mary and the family of Joseph? They were part of that huge emigration. When Jesus ministered, he came to offer himself to the Jews. He had to go to the Jews, where the Jews were. He spent most of his time, 18 months, in Galilee. That's where most of the Jews are. Now, the point is, Jesus understands, and we can reconstruct, the habits of those Galilean Jews when they came down for Passover. Now, watch this. There are two routes by which you can get from Galilee in the north to Jerusalem, to Judea. Are you with me? This is geography, and I just say the word and your eyes glaze over, I know, but it's important, folks. So here it is. Oh, and here's the Jezreel Valley, which is once you step down out of the hills of Ephraim or Samaria into this beautiful arrowhead-shaped valley, which is the most important valley on the face of the earth, you're in Galilee, all right? So there are two routes, and their habit, I should say, the habit seems to have been that they would gather many times in the Jezreel Valley. You would never make this trip singly because it was dangerous, no matter what route you took. And so you would gather in large bands, maybe synagogues or villages or clans or whatever, and you would gather there in the valley, and the men would be on the outside and the women and the children on the inside. Remember when Mary and Joseph, for a whole day, didn't see it. They both thought him to be in the company. Remember that? That's what's at stake. So at any rate, so they would gather, and Jesus had done this year by year. Now watch. They could either take from the Jezreel Valley the route they would like to take. It's called the Central Ridge Route, the Way of the Patriarchs. It's this series of ridges and dips and so on that does. See the hill country of both Judea and Samaria. It's all these steep hillsides and ridges, and the ridges don't necessarily connect, but there's one windy route that does in fact stay pretty much atop those ridges and goes all the way from, actually it goes all the way from the Jezreel Valley all the way down to Beersheba. It falls off at Beersheba to the south, but the point is that this is called the Ridge Route. Got it? There's going to be a quiz. It's called the Bema Seat. I'm telling you, this is going to come up. I'm confident. It's called the Ridge Route because it stays up on the ridge. Now, the problem is that it passes through the heart of Samaria. It's about 60 miles from the Jezreel Valley. On the other hand, the other route, and because Samaria is largely impassable, I mean, it's just dangerous. And listen, Rome had established the Pax Romana, and you had this heavy-handed but effective lack of battles and so on. But locally, the Samaritans would fall upon if the Jews were making their way, especially at feast seasons. Look, in Luke 9, on another occasion, Jesus passed through Samaria. He left Capernaum, and it says that he came to a Samaritan village, and they would not receive him because it was the feast. This is actually the Feast of Tabernacles in the fall. But so at any rate, so there was another route. Now watch this. It's called the Rift, R-I-F-T route, because it follows the Jordan Rift. This, see if I can do this without making myself any trouble. This right here, come on, talk to me, is the Jordan Rift. Now it's not the entirety of it. It's called the Syrio-African Rift because it starts up in Syria and goes all the way to Central Africa. But the deepest part of it is right here. And this rift, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea, it starts, the Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level. It's on its surface. The Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level, and it's 1,200 feet deep. So this is the deepest cleft on the face of the earth. It's carefully designed by God for a number. It's so important to the way the biblical narrative plays out. But the point is, the rift route, watch this now, they would leave the Jezreel Valley, come down from the Galilee, and then they would go and ford the Jordan River. And then they would make their way down the east side, and that is a very important local route. All of the traffic in the rift is going to be on the east side for reasons I could get into. But now you get down to about Jericho on the other side, and you reford the Jordan River, and you make your way up the backside, the eastern slope of the Mount of Olives. And you cross the Mount of Olives, and there's Jerusalem. Now, you've got these two routes. The Bible says that, right there, Luke 17, that he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. Let me suggest something to you. You may find it a little radical, but be a little patient with me. You know, in John chapter 4, when Jesus, now going north, and he tells his disciples, he's leaving, he ministers in Judea for the early months of his ministry, now he's going to go up to that Galilean ministry, and he says, I need to go through Samaria. Now, that was a bit radical. And he goes through Samaria, and along the way, he encounters a woman, and you know that story in John 4, and then he's invited to the village, and they love him. I think what's going on there, without getting myself in trouble, but I know that I'll make trouble, but let me just say, I think that what's going on there is Jesus is deliberately establishing personal standing in Samaria. He's going to use it again and again. He is going to be able to go. Remember I told you in Luke 9 when he's making his way down for the Feast of Tabernacles and it says the village wouldn't receive him. Remember Peter and John wanted to call fire and all that sort of stuff. And it says so he went on to another village. So the next Samaritan village accepted him. Jesus had standing. You know, one of the other things, important things about reading the Bible in terms of its own culture, this is so big. Get used to this. It's fun and it defines so much that goes on. These people, both Old and New Testament, it was a clan culture. You lived as an extended family, as a much extended family. There's a fellow I've gotten to know, it's a really nice story. It's a restaurant in Jericho, and I usually stop there when we stop at the Green Valley restaurant. Do you remember all those years ago? I may have developed this relationship since, but. And the man who runs it, his name is Cotter, and he's a wonderful Christian, has a wonderful ministry. But his father owns the restaurant. And his father, I don't think he's a believer. As a matter of fact, he's not a believer. He's a Muslim. But he's a great gentleman, and I've gotten to know him a little bit. So not too long ago, several years ago, actually, but I was talking to him, just making conversation. He told me, yeah, I'm going to Houston. I said, oh, you're going to Houston? You got people in Houston? Oh, yeah. My people started going there, and so I've got family in Houston. And I said, about how many? He said, I think about 1,200. So, I mean, that's a clan. Does that make sense to you? And that's how Samaria runs. It's a clan. So if Jesus has standing he plays it. He's wise as a serpent. And he plays it to his remarkable advantage because there's a price on his head. So what does he do? Well, let's read the Bible. It came to pass, remember, he's at Ephraim. I'm identifying Ephraim right here at a little market. It's just north of Jerusalem, due north of Jerusalem. But as he went to Jerusalem, he passed through the midst of Samaria and Galilee. So here is Jesus' route. He makes his way up through Samaria where he is safe because this is feast season and none of those Jewish leaders is going to wander into Ephraim itself is right on the border. So he knows he's kind of in a safe haven there in Ephraim because the Jewish leaders are not going to try and get in there. They'd be in big trouble. Now he goes north. Now again, remember that thousands of Jews are gathering in Galilee and setting off, not necessarily one group, but these groups are gathering. And so quite clearly, it says in the midst of Galilee, he would be there once he got into the Jezreel Valley. And I think probably, he may have gone further, but I think at this point, he falls in with one of those bands of Passover pilgrims. And then it says, passing through the midst of Samaria and Galilee, and this is how he would have gone to Jerusalem. And we know this is the route he followed. I'll show you in a minute. But he would go down the Herod Valley, down that same road on the eastern side, ford the Jordan River, and then make his way up toward Jerusalem. But two points. Number one, he's traveling with hundreds of people. And as he goes, and this is going to be at least a five or six, this is about a 90-mile trip. And the last leg of the trip is from the Dead Sea up to the top. The Mount of Olives is 2,700 feet above sea level. The Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level. That's a 4,000-foot incline in about 15 miles. So it's a tough, but you got to do it because the Samaritans make trouble for you. So he travels with those Passover pilgrims, and Matthew and Mark tell this very, very carefully. And all along the way, he's doing miracles. This is when he heals the 10 lepers. This is when he heals the two blind men at Jericho, which is how we know that he took this route, because he stops at Jericho. He's being very much the provocateur. This is when he invites himself to lunch with a taxpayer. Oh, the gasp that would have gone up from the crowd. They're worried about being unclean, and they think that because they're going to the feast, for heaven's sake. They don't want to encounter any uncleanness. And here's this diminutive Zacchaeus up in the tree, and everybody knows, he probably wears a specific uniform, and anyway, everybody in that town knows Zacchaeus. And so at any rate, Jesus is... He's teaching all along the way. He's confronting the Pharisees from afar and so on. So Jesus is in full messianic operational mode, doing miracles and challenging the wicked leadership and so on. And I got to think that maybe the crowd he was traveling with kept getting... By the way, time out. One of the dynamics of an oral culture is they develop really, really clever and effective means of sharing. Jesus couldn't be heard by hundreds. Well, he might in a certain situation, but he's on the road. He's not in some acoustical hillside. But they would pass it on. What did he say? So here he is all along the way teaching and so on. And but I said that they're headed for Jerusalem. But now we got to go to John 12. So, as a matter of fact, I have it here. John 12, verse 1 says, now I can develop this for you. I'm just giving you the conclusions. But John 12 says, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised. Just a few weeks earlier, he had raised Lazarus from the dead. Now, walk with me, if you will. Here we come. We're making a very, very difficult ascent all the way up the backside of the Mount of Olives. And everybody is, and it's Friday. 6 days before the Passover is Friday. The Passover is Thursday. So 6 days before the Passover, Jesus, and you're making your way up. And what happens when the sun goes down on Friday? Right? Shabbat. And there are very careful restrictions, and they're not necessarily Levitical, but everybody lives by them. For one of them, about a Sabbath day journey. Now, a Sabbath day's journey was about a mile and two-fifths. You'll see different calculations. But the point is not that it was linear. Like you walked that many steps and then you got to sit down and wait for the sun to go down. It was a zone. And wherever you are, when the sun went down, you draw that circle around you, a mile and two-fifths. You can move around as much as you want in that zone. Bethany was just outside the Sabbath zone. Now, what that means is, if you're in Bethany when the sun goes down, you can't go into the city until the sun goes down on Saturday. Does that make sense? And if you're in the city, you can't go out to Bethany until the sun goes down on Saturday. So now it says that Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was. Now, here's, I started out. How did Jesus get away with it? And I think the Bible, have I made anything up here? I mean, all of these are Bible verses. And the point is that now Jesus stops in Bethany. And by the way, to this day, as you come up what's called the ascent of Adumim, because the rocks are red and so on, you come up that road. Now, it doesn't follow exactly the ancient road, which is Wadi Kilt. But nonetheless, even as you come up the modern highway from Jericho, climbing steeply up into Jerusalem, just before, you can see there are three towers on the top of Mount of Olives. They call them the Three Sisters. You know, I'll point out there. That's the top of Mount of Olives. And once you get up there, you're going to be looking right down at the temple and so on. And so here you are. You're coming along. And I was going to say, to this day, just before you crest that hill, under a mile, there's a road that goes off to the south, to the left, and it goes to Bethany. Now, you can't take it today because of the wall, but I'm hoping the wall may be gone soon enough. But at any rate, the point is that here you are. You're traveling with Jesus, You're breathless to get to Jerusalem. That's where you're going. You've listened to his teachings and watched his miracles, and maybe the baby in your arms was born deaf and now she isn't anymore. You know what I'm saying? It's just a lot of excitement as you make your way up the hill. But just before you crest the hill, you watch as Jesus and his disciples take that road toward Bethany. And you know the story of Lazarus. And you know that you're all thinking about how where we're going to be to keep the Shabbat. And you know he's going to keep Sabbath with Lazarus. But hundreds of excited people go into Jerusalem. And what is everybody in Jerusalem standing around asking? See the point? That's why John gives us that. Do you think he'll come to Jerusalem? And here are several hundred people who get what I like to call their Warholian 15 minutes, if you know what I'm saying. All of a sudden, because I would argue that all of these hundreds of people went into the city bearing two messages. Number one, he is coming. We know he's coming. We've been traveling with him. That's what they're asking. Is he coming to the feast? You bet. It's so exciting. He's coming to the feast. But number two, he'll be here Sunday morning because he stopped in Bethany. And Bethany is outside the Sabbath zone. So we won't be able to come into the city until Sunday morning. And now, this is Friday, and there are a couple of days for that message to percolate through the city. And the city is crowded beyond what you can imagine. But all of these people, locals and travelers, pilgrims and so on, families and clans, and he began to say, the Nazarene is coming. Now, they may have said to themselves, very likely, you know, my rabbi insists that he's an imposter. So he probably is, but my goodness. You know, my sister had a son who was lame, and he's jumping all over the place today because Jesus healed him. So what can it hurt? Let's go. There's only one road from Bethany to Jerusalem. So let's just go see. And so now, without any concert, without any schedule, without any social media, but because Jesus, here, let me show you something. Because Jesus has informed the city that he's coming. Let me take you to John 12. Did I have John open? Yeah, John 12, right here. Look at this, verse 12. As John, his telling of the triumphal entry, he says, the next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem, how did they hear? Are you with me? How did Jesus get away with it? He alerted the whole city. And in Matthew, it's explicit. I love the way Matthew tells the story. He says, this is his story, but he says, a very great multitude spread their clothes and others cut down branches and so on. The multitudes who went before followed. And by the way, all right, this is where I want to take you. What had Jesus said there in Perea to those angry Pharisees? You're not going to see me until you cry out, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. If you'd have been there, you'd have said, it's not going to happen, can't happen. Guess what? Jesus knows how to make it happen. So now here they are. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And then verse 10 says, when he had come to Jerusalem, all the city was moved, saying, who is this? And the multitudes. Now, there's some confusion, but the point is the whole city came out to welcome him. And neither the Romans nor the Jews could arrest the whole city. That make sense to you? Why? How did Jesus get away with it? He prepared. Now, so I'd love to keep going and talk about the triumphal entry and this marvelous. It's a day I call a messianic presentation. That day is, in fact, all throughout his ministry, Jesus had made the claim to be Messiah, but he had to be very circumspect about it. He didn't use the word Messiah of himself because he knew his enemies would make merchandise of that. But now he rides in, and in fulfillment of those three lines of Old Testament prophecy, Zechariah 9, and I think Daniel 9, and Psalm 118, he rides into the city, and they do, in fact, cry out, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. All right, now I want to take you one other place in Matthew chapter 23. Let me just get there. I think it's 34. Am I right about that? It's right at the end of Matthew 23, so it's further. Right here, Matthew 23 and verse 37. Now listen, honest to goodness, what I set out to do, I asked the question, how did Jesus get away with it? And my argument is that the narrative, we can trace it, the verses are explicit, that by reason of his travel, he did it very deliberately in order to alert the city to his coming. And then John 12 tells us that the city had heard that Jesus was coming. Does that make sense to you? He said, I'm saying out of Matthew 10, he was wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove. Now let me just close with one other note here. Because on Tuesday afternoon, after Jesus leaves the city of Jerusalem, having spoken these withering, excoriating woes upon the scribes and Pharisees, I love to talk to you about it, and having watched the woman, in contrast to that, deposit her little few cents in the alms baskets as they had there, but now as he leaves the city, he's on his way to Bethany, where he stayed throughout the week. And by the way, Bethany, let me just say one other thing. There is a curiosity, there's an element of Eastern, really, culture, not just Jewish, but Eastern. And we know it as hospitality. But what the idea is that if I accept you into my home, if I accept you as a guest, I become absolutely duty-bound to keep you secure. I will surrender anything, including, in the case of Job, rather disgustingly, and in the case of that Ephraimite, a Levite in Judges 19, even my own family. Remember that? And so, and you're duty-bound. I used to travel in Israel with a Bedouin bus driver. I loved the guy, but he was crazy, and I couldn't depend on him. But at any rate, and I would ask him to talk to the, he had come to the Lord, and I'd ask him to just talk to the bus about Bedouin life and so on, and he would go on and on about this. I would give up my fortune, my family, anything to keep you secure. Well, you see, Lazarus lived in Bethany. Bethany loved Jesus. So all throughout the Passion Week, he makes his way at night back to Bethany, where he's safe. He's right on the road. There are always people traveling back and forth and so on. So again, here he is on Tuesday afternoon. He's going out to Bethany, and he's going to cross the Mount of Olives. And when he gets up to the Mount of Olives, you remember his disciples are going to look back at the temple, and they're going to say, wow, look at those buildings and those stones. And Jesus is going to say, not one stone is upon another. But before that, that's Matthew 24, he says this. I'm going to read it out loud. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. You are not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you'll not see me. You'll see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Does that sound familiar? That's not parallel. Luke 13 is in Perea, just weeks before the Passover. Now, once again, Jesus says to the city, you're not going to see me until you welcome me as Messiah. This is what thrills my heart. You see, the difference between Luke 13 and Matthew 23 is Luke 13 stands fulfilled. It's the triumphal entry. We know the story. Matthew 23 awaits fulfillment. Now, if you'd have been there on that day and heard Jesus say, to those Pharisees, you'll not see me. You'd have said, it's not going to happen. He made it happen. If you know anything, and I don't mean to be disparaging, about the Jewish world and how difficult evangelism is and so on, it is the more mind-numbing to say, how can that happen? Is the nation of Israel in fulfillment of God's absolutely explicit covenant of promise, are they actually going to, a generation of Israel come in faith? That's what God promised. And I take it as Ebenezer. He's brought us this far. He'll take us the rest of the way. That here, as we've traced, Jesus made the promise and he knew how to fulfill it. Now on Tuesday afternoon, he makes another promise. Same promise to a generation. He knows how to fulfill it. Amen and amen. It's going to happen. Father, thank you for your... We rejoice over who you are. We are surrounded every moment of our lives by your goodness in such dramatic ways, and we're so careless about that, we tend to overlook it. But thank you for who you are, but thank you, Father, for the and of all your goodness, the greatest of your gifts is your Son. And thank you for not only the life that he lived and the death that he died, but the absolutely dependable, careful history we have recorded in these four Gospels. And thank you, Father, for thank you for that day when he announced that he is, in fact, the long-awaited Messiah deliverer, first promise in Genesis 3. We love you for sending him. We love him for coming on our behalf. And it's in his name we praise you. Amen.
We pray you've been edified by this presentation. You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Calvary Bible Church in Jolton, Tennessee. For more information on Calvary Bible Church, or for more audio, please visit our website at cbctn.org.